You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we discuss the surging attacks on Indigenous rights in BC and across Canada, on The Breach Show, investigate the ways AI impacts our lives and the environment, on Barry Grounds, explore the importance of the Palestinian exception to on-campus repression on student power, and look at how referendum questions fuel anti-immigrant feeling in Alberta on Red Eye. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this highlight from a recent episode, Desmond Cole sits down with lawyer Pam Palmiter to investigate how the corporate resource rush is fueling BC's backlash against Indigenous rights. Now, here's Desmond.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. BC Premier David Eby has been threatening to change or even suspend laws enshrining Indigenous rights in his province. Eby has suggested that private property could be under threat because of court decisions recognizing Indigenous land and title. First Nations say they're not coming for Canadians' private property, and Eby is whipping up unfounded fears. So why are so many BC politicians upset with a law that received unanimous support only a few years ago? And what happens if they weaken it? Joining me to discuss all this is Pam Palmiter, a lawyer, professor, writer, and a member of the Eel River Bar First Nation. She is the chair of Indigenous governance at the Toronto Metropolitan University, a regular media commentator, and the author of several books, including Indigenous Nationhood and Warrior Life. Nice to see you, Pam.
Great to be back.
And as we get started, just a reminder to our audiences to like and subscribe if you want more bold journalism for transformation. Okay, Pam, the law causing all of this furor in BC is called the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act, or DRIPA. And those words might sound familiar to people because this law puts into action UNDRIP, or the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which the Trudeau government enacted 5 years ago. So to begin, please help us understand what DRIPA is and what it does.
Well, DRIPA is actually pretty historic because it is the province of BC affirming that the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, all of those human rights that are recognized and protected in that document that already applies to Canada, specifically is part of the laws of BC, and that all BC laws must be consistent with that. And that law was passed under the former Premier John Horgan. But interestingly enough, it was when, under that same government, when Eby was the Attorney General, he also put forth an amendment to BC's Interpretation Act to say that no laws in BC can abrogate or derogate, like take away from constitutionally protected Aboriginal treaty rights under Section 35, or the human rights that are protected in UNDRIP. So that's very specific, so that you've got one law saying UNDRIP applies and you've got another law saying, and oh, by the way, courts, if you have to interpret, these apply.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's court decisions that seem to have troubled EB to the point where he's threatening to either suspend or amend certain parts of DRIPA. There's a case in particular that's being cited as a source of a lot of anxiety in BC called the Cowichan decision, which recognized the Cowichan Nation's title over hundreds of hectares of land in the Richmond, BC area, which includes a lot of private property that's currently owned by Canadians. Can you help us understand this Cowichan decision?
Yeah, so first of all, the majority of Aboriginal title court cases come from BC. You know, you had the Delgamuukw case, which was historic, saying, yeah, Aboriginal title exists and we have to recognize it. Then you have the Tsilhqot'in case, which said, oh yeah, here's the very first declaration here. And now you have another one. So it's not new. And I think what the fear is that First Nations are going to march into residential neighborhoods and start kicking people out of their homes, which they have no legal authority to do. And not a single First Nation in the history of Aboriginal title claims have ever said, we're kicking out all these, you know, private interests and farms and everything else. That's not how it works. Aboriginal title, Crown title, and private interests, none of them are absolute. And you can have third-party interests and Aboriginal title over the same land. It's about sitting down and negotiating, okay, well, what does that mean? Does that mean a part of the taxes will go to the First Nation? Does that mean there's going to be joint governing decisions over, like, bylaws and things like that? But under no conditions does it mean anyone is losing their home. It never has been. But that's the biggest misinformation fear campaign that has ever existed since First Nations made Aboriginal title claims.
Okay, but this is what's so confusing about what's happening in British Columbia, because the law doesn't allow for Indigenous nations to come and take private property away from its owners. The First Nations say they have no intention of doing that. And moreover, and David Eby knows this as Premier and, as you said, former Attorney General, this court case about Cowichan started before DRIPA was the law in BC. So Pam, what's going on? Why is the Premier citing this law if it's not putting into play the things that he's suggesting?
I just have to say, in general, whether it's a federal or provincial government, Aboriginal rights are well and good, and we support them and we respect them and we uphold them until we have to. Right? So it's easy to put it in the Constitution. Governments had no problem saying we're going to constitutionally protect Aboriginal treaty and Aboriginal title rights. But then as soon as court cases start saying, okay, they have rights, then it's a big panic. Oh no, all economic interests are going to be impacted. All third parties are going to be impacted. We're going to lose political power over specific territories. So it really comes down to political power. But I think the biggest issue really is not even the third party, it's the corporate interests. So it's the corporate interests, for the most part, that drive the fear-mongering and misinformation. And you see all of these social media campaigns that, you know, the world is coming to an end. I think that's the biggest thing here. And we all know that corporate interests have disproportionate amount of political influence. So the corporate interests, like in the first case that really upset them, that said that the free-for-all mining claims that can be made by non-Native people over First Nation territories, that's wholly inconsistent with UNDRIP. And so you need to do something about that, change that process, because there needs to be consultation, free, prior, and informed consent. So my suspicion that it's probably somewhere around there, and you can never get away from elections. You know, first this was going to be a confidence issue, and then you've got NDP MPs saying, well, we don't support this either. And then all of a sudden, well, it's not going to be a confidence issue, because what if our government falls? And the world has changed. You know how in the last 3 or 4 years, the far right, anti-women, anti-human rights, anti-social justice, anti-environment has just flourished all over. And so conservative governments have been picking that up and trying to run with this, these populist ideologies, and to see how effective it is. So there's a lot more at play than anything that could really happen.
The Conservative Party in BC, which had zero seats, by the way, when DRIPA was actually passed. DRIPA was passed unanimously. But the Conservatives were really out of the political picture at that time. They've made a resurgence in British Columbia, and they don't just want to alter or amend DRIPA. They want to repeal it completely, and they don't want to say what, if anything, they would replace it with. So do you think that this is part of that conservative backlash that you're talking about? Or is this actually... It seems to be something that politicians across the board in British Columbia, even though it might be driven by the Conservatives, are comfortable putting into the public sphere.
Yeah, so I'm not surprised at all by the Conservatives, because we've seen this wave where Conservatives are, you know, hopping on this far-right populist, you know, hate campaign, and in hopes that it'll get them elected. I mean, look at Doug Ford, look at Pierre Poilievre and others. And so I'm not at all surprised that Conservatives were looking for a way to gain some kind of support. And right now, the only kind of support they could realistically gain in a progressive province like BC, a more progressive, is to try to go with this populist campaign. Because keep in mind, we've seen a rise in anti-First Nations, Indian residential school denialism. There's like a whole bunch of that brewing. And you see behind that, who's behind that? Conservative people hoping that they will get some kind of notoriety, popularity, maybe become the next government in BC. Hope not. And that is a disservice to people, BC residents and First Nations, because a lot of that is based on hate, anger, fear, misinformation, not reality.
David Eby is the new Democrat premier, of course. And when he said that he first wanted to change or amend or suspend parts of DRIPA, First Nations came out in full force saying, absolutely not. The First Nations Leadership Council in BC basically says EB is threatening human rights in the province and that they're going to take legal action if he does do anything. So he has changed his position, Pam, like 5 or 6 times in recent weeks on this issue. He says he's going to amend DRIPA. Then he says he's going to suspend parts of it. He says it's non-negotiable. And then earlier this week, after a letter from the First Nations Leadership Council, he said, we're not actually going to touch DRIPA at all. What do you make of his inability to make a decision on this issue?
Nothing about politicians surprises me. However, that's a bit surprising because he was part of the government that fully 100% supported DRIPA. And then he was the Attorney General when they made sure to also amend the Interpretation Act to make sure that, you know, if courts have to interpret this, that it must be consistent with Indigenous rights. And it was celebrated. And this was something that came about jointly between BC government and First Nations. And there's very strong relations, political relations, partnerships, you name it, in BC. BC First Nations are very, very strong in that area and always work on relationships. I mean, he was there at the Haida title announcement saying, this is great. This is historic. This is how recognition of rights should happen. So I was like, okay, he's still good on rights recognition. But as soon as the court case says, wait a second, BC, your mining regime of free for all without even talking to First Nations, that's not consistent with UNDRIP. Then he starts backtracking and says, oh no, legal liability on the part of the province. And oh no, because keep in mind, who's primarily making these stakes, right? That tend to be larger corporations. What people need to remember is, even if UNDRIP didn't apply in BC, the Supreme Court of Canada has said over and over and over and over and over again that there is a legal duty to consult when it's mining or anything that's happening on First Nation traditional territories, a legal duty to consult, accommodate their interests, and in many cases get consent. So that law already exists in Canada. That's why when you see a politician backing up and saying, oh, wait, this could be disastrous, you think, okay, well, what's really at play here? Because surely he hasn't had a philosophical change of heart. Keep in mind, Canadian mining corporations are some of the biggest in the world and the most devastating to Indigenous territories all over the world, including Canada, and has some of the highest human rights violations that they get away with near impunity. So I suspect there's the political element, but there's also this corporate push behind the scenes.
This is a highlight from a recent episode of The Breach Show. Find new episodes at breachmedia.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up next. With an eye to power, the independent editor-in-chief, Justin Brake, and guests have been taking a closer look at issues impacting Newfoundland and Labrador since 2023. On this highlight from a new episode, Tech Won't Save Us host Paris Marks in St. John's joins Justin in Corner Brook for a virtual conversation unpacking the ways AI is impacting our lives and the environment. Now, here's Justin.
Welcome to Barry Grounds. I'm Justin Brake. One day as I'm working away, an email from a reader lands in my inbox. They had a look at the Government of Newfoundland and Labrador's Health Human Resources Report, a 500-plus page document laying out problems and solutions for the province's healthcare staffing crisis. Written by accounting and consulting firm Deloitte Canada at a cost to the public of almost $1.6 million, the report contained multiple citations that we confirmed were fake, made up, non-existent. It was the second apparent AI scandal in the province in almost as many months. Earlier last fall, CBC Radio Canada broke the story about how the province's 10-year education accord contained AI-generated errors. The so-called hallucinations that generative artificial intelligence programs create? Well, those are just one of the many problems people around the world are facing since this new technology exploded onto the scene just a few years ago and continues to permeate our lives in ways we don't even fully recognize, let alone understand. If, like me, you've been noticing and watching AI pop up in places like social media, creative industries, government reports, but also, like me, haven't taken the time to really dig into what AI is and how it works and understand how it's impacting our lives and the environment, then the conversation you're about to hear is a good place to start. I invited tech journalist, author, and podcast host Paris Marks to join me for a hybrid in-person and virtual conversation on the evening of April 25th, 2026. Paris joined us from St. John's, and I was joined by a few dozen audience members at the Rotary Arts Centre in Corner Brook. Here's the recording of Ready or Not, AI is Here.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining our event tonight. My name is Kayla Mintz, and I'm a board member of The Independent.
Good evening, everyone. And my name is Jonathan Ludi, and I am the chair of the board of directors of The Independent. So, as we all know, this is a critical moment for the future of media, broadly speaking, but perhaps a live-or-die moment for independent journalism in Newfoundland and Labrador.
Last month, we learned The Independent was chosen as part of the cohort of the first ever Journalism Futures Fund, a three-year grant to support small independent news outlets that, in the words of Inspirit, produce impactful journalism, have a strong vision for their future, and are led by members of the communities underserved in Canadian media. This grant will allow us to do something we've never been able to do since becoming a nonprofit media outlet in 2014, hire a publisher.
That exciting news was followed by a major disappointment. Last week, we learned that we lost critical core funding to hire reporters in St. John's and Labrador. But economic instability isn't new to The Independent. We are resilient and will weather this storm because of the readers who support the kind of journalism that we are known for.
Over the last year, the Indy broke several big news stories. We acknowledge that some address sensitive issues. These include the women who came forward with serious allegations against a gynecologist in Labrador. That coverage led NL Health Services to change its policy on how it works with Indigenous governments, and the India is continuing to follow the story.
Or the fact that we're one of only two provinces that could not provide data on whether gambling addiction played a potential role in suicides here, where we earn more than $100 million a year in revenue from legalized gambling. Last week, we reported that a year after our investigation, the province's chief medical examiner has officially begun collecting data on gambling-related suicides.
Or how about the one we're here to talk about today, the Deloitte AI scandal? The Independent confirmed the global consulting firm used AI to generate citations for some of the claims it made in the Health Human Resources Report for the province. The Indy kept up the questions and pressure on both the province and Deloitte. And kudos to Justin on this one. We recently learned that, days after we broke that story, the province added safeguards to its public procurement process to avoid any similar scandals in the future.
Here's the thing. With the loss of funding, we won't be producing as many stories by as many journalists this year, unless we see a boost in reader support. Behind the scenes, we're laying the groundwork for a major push for support as we continue publishing hard-hitting, investigative, and accountability journalism. So there's never been a better or more critical time to get involved with the Indy, either as a board member, you can also become a volunteer, there are details on the website there about how to do that, or by becoming a donor, whether that's making a one-time donation, as many of you did tonight, thank you very much, or becoming a monthly donor. So with that, please join me in welcoming Editor-in-Chief of The Independent, Justin Brake.
This is a first for us in terms of, we've done live streams before, but the first time using this program, Riverside, it's all AI. I'm just joking. We're using Riverside, so we are being joined virtually by Paris Marks, who I'll introduce in a moment, but you can see Paris now. Paris lives in St. John's, and on the budget we had, couldn't afford to bring him here first class on the DRL. So thanks for joining us. It's a really nice to see so many faces here in person. And as John and Kayla mentioned, I'm editor-in-chief at The Independent. We're a very small operation. We've been running as a nonprofit for a little over a decade now. And because of readers, mostly people in Newfoundland and Labrador over the last decade, we've slowly grown to be bringing in enough revenue from reader donations to be able to pay a full-time staff member. So that's a huge accomplishment in a province our size, I think. The reason we're all here tonight is to talk about AI. And part of the reason I had the idea of doing this event is because until recently, I wasn't paying close attention to AI. I heard things about it. I've heard terms like generative AI. I've heard about how it's going to help us progress in so many facets of our lives. And I've also heard about a lot of the issues and problems and concerns around AI. So I thought, we have a good opportunity to bring people together and talk about this. And we're also very lucky, again, as a province our size, to be the place that produced Paris Marks, who travels around the world talking about big technology and artificial intelligence and has written books, does a podcast that's really popular, has a newsletter. I'll say more about. Actually, let me introduce Paris now, because everybody can see you, Paris, and I keep pointing to you and looking at you. So Paris is a Canadian tech critic and host of the award-winning Tech Won't Save Us podcast. He speaks around the world, like I said, about the politics of technology and writes the Disconnect newsletter. Paris is the author of Road to Nowhere, and his next book, Hyperscale, is coming out later this year. He's also from the Buren Peninsula and now lives in St. John's. Thanks for joining us, Paris. We're really glad to have you here.
Absolutely. Happy to join you.
So I'll just talk a little bit about our Deloitte coverage real quickly, Paris, and we'll get into our conversation.
Sounds good.
About, when was this? And this was October, November. One day I opened up my email inbox. There was an email from someone who told me that there appeared to be AI-generated errors in the province's Health Human Resources Plan. And that plan was commissioned by the provincial government to help address the crisis that we are all acutely aware of in this province in healthcare staffing, nurses and doctors. And the province paid Deloitte Canada, which is part of the global Deloitte firm. Deloitte is one of the biggest accounting firms in the world. And accounting and consulting is what I meant to say, firms in the world. And so You know, we paid $1.6 million. And if you think about the times we've heard our government say we don't have the money for very important essential services, $1.6 million is not just a little bit of money. That can go a long way to building a new school, improving one of the hospitals in the province, right? So I looked into it. I went through the 526-page report, and I fact-checked every citation made in the report. And for those of you who don't know, in academics, in research, when you make a claim about something, and it's something that somebody else has already proven, you cite where that information came from. And so what I confirmed was that Deloitte, in its report for the provincial government, was citing sources that don't exist. And the reason it was apparent that AI was involved is because some of the researchers whose names were in these citations do exist. And some of the journals that were named in these citations do exist. So I started emailing some of these researchers, and they were very quick to get back to me and wanted to get on the phone. They had no idea their name was being attached to a $1.6 million research report that was going to inform government policy around healthcare. So when I, you know, when we confirmed this, we quickly went to the government and said, here's what we found. What do you say? You know, and it's important to note, too, that this followed like only 2 months after CBC Radio Canada broke the story about how our 10-year education accord also contained AI generated errors. And those errors, it appears, were made within government after the report was filed to government. That's not confirmed, but the researchers who co-authored the report said it must have happened within government, and the government kind of indicated to me in a not so direct way that those likely were generated within government. So Newfoundland and Labrador, two major reports in 2 months at a huge cost to taxpayers, had reports that were going to inform government policy that included errors generated by artificial intelligence. Deloitte, it should be noted as well, just a few months prior to our story in November, was caught in a similar scandal in Australia and ended up repaying hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Australian government for the errors generated by artificial intelligence in that report. So this is a big issue. It's happening in other parts of the world. It's happening with at least one of the biggest global consulting firms. It's probably happening elsewhere. The AI program that Deloitte used in its report for the Australian government was it's called a large language model. And Paris can probably explain a little bit more about that to us in a moment. I don't know if that's the same program the firm used in the healthcare report here, but I think, Paris, that's probably a good entry point to our broader discussion of AI, because we're seeing and hearing about it in so many different forms and contexts. Can you give us like kind of a basic explanation of what artificial intelligence is?
Sure thing. Yeah, I can do my best, you know. And just on what you're saying about these reports, right? I've been writing about technology for a long time, certainly been writing about AI recently, because, you know, it's been like such a big topic in the past few years. And then like to see other people who I know who comment on these issues and who write about these issues, who report on these issues, all of a sudden start sharing around stories about a report in Newfoundland and Labrador containing AI citations. I was like, no, this is not how I want my province to kind of be in the discourse around these issues. So yeah, that kind of sucked, to be quite honest. But, you know, it was going to happen somewhere, I guess. And at least it helped kind of kick off an important conversation and you know, hopefully made people in the province more aware of these issues and kind of what's going on with it as well. Right. Maybe that's one of like my more positive, like kind of hopes out of this. So, you know, to get to your question, I guess I would say there are many different ways that we can think about AI. Right. And you know, when we talk about AI today, effectively what we're often talking about is generative AI, right? You know, the chatbots, the image generators, you know, the video generators. I just saw yesterday that OpenAI is kind of taking its video generator offline called Sora for a number of reasons. So that is kind of like what we understand AI to be at the moment. But really, AI is as a term, as an approach to making technology, has been around since the 50s, right? Like, it's not a wholly new thing. The difference is that, you know, it evolves over time as researchers find new things and the nature of the technology changes and what it can do and it gets more powerful and all that kind of stuff. So I would say, first of all, you know, if you think of something like spell check on your phone, or if you're typing something in Google Docs or Microsoft Word, and it's kind of saying, hey, you might have spelled this word wrong, or, you know, maybe you should construct this sentence in a different way.